Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain standing for the singing of our national anthem.
Let's get Brexit done.
My administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country.
Hello and welcome to Mid-Atlantic, the show where we look at the news and the views from one side of the Atlantic from the perspective of the other. I'm Royfield Brown, who is in a rather sunny and glorious Bay Area. Today, I'm joined by my friends. Not all of them do I have on my script, so after I run through and name check a few of them, I'm going to ask the others who haven't been name checked to name check themselves. Today, I'm joined by Laura Babcock, TV pundit from Hamilton in Canada. Eric Marcus should be joining us. He's from the Making Gay History podcast in New York. Mike Holden is with us. He's in Burnley in England. He's a friend of Donald Trump, I do believe. We have Clint Lotti, ex-Capitol Hill staffer in Washington, D.C. And we have the writer and always up for it all-round naughty girl, Emma Burnell in London. Now, we have a crowded stage, which befits our new format. We're going to do things very slightly differently. So, Scott, do we have you with us?
We do.
And you're in Tennessee, aren't you?
I'm in Nashville, baby.
Same thing. Then we have Ab, and I believe you're in the Lone Star State.
Yes, sir. Dallas, Texas.
We are joined by a friend of the podcast, Dawn. You're in North Somerset.
Yes. Sorry.
Brilliant. No, a yes will suffice. And then we have Chris Kachuna, the returning hero of this podcast from some 3 years ago vintage. Chris, you are in London. Which part of London?
I'm in Islington, and I like that title, Returning Hero. Do I get a parade?
Yes, ticker tape parade. It'll be like the 4th of July all over again as soon as the podcast is over. And last but definitely not least, we have my good friend, the woman who I speak to every day on Clubhouse, Kathy in Newport. Hello, Kathy from Newport.
Hello, everybody. My name's Kathy, and I will be your parade director, Chris, so we'll be chatting later. Goodbye.
Fantastic. In a week that has seen the British Navy send warships to the coast of France, just like it's 1792, we ask, just why has the Biden administration angered Big Pharma? President Joe Biden has given his support to waiving intellectual property rights for COVID-19 vaccines after pressure from the Democrats and more than 100 other countries. Ab, I believe you're an all-round expert on this matter. You also advocated for it on WhatsApp. Why is this such a big deal?
Well, it's a big deal because currently vaccine production is not meeting the rates necessary, especially for poor and developing countries at the moment. Whereas us in the US and in Europe, we do have the benefits of being able to have the vaccine. And if anything, we have a great amount of the vaccine actually being thrown away here in the United States because people just aren't taking it. But that's another subject. But currently, countries like India, which are making up about 43% of the new cases, as well as, you know, it's starting to spread in surrounding countries like Nepal and Bangladesh and stuff. So there is definitely a need for ramping up vaccine production, which was something that was drafted. This waiver was actually, it's still in the development stage, but it was drafted by particularly India and South Africa. And it has been having some pushback from Europe and the United States. But this reversal, I believe, is only one step, a very necessary global collaboration, because it will require not just the pharmaceutical companies that own the IP to make it available, but also we're going to need a technology transfer where they're going to have to show, particularly with the mRNA vaccine, how it's done. Because what you don't want is you don't want to have other companies imitating it and getting it wrong, because that can definitely lead to some unintended consequences, especially if these other generic versions do not meet certain, you know, markers of quality.
Is it right and proper that us in the developed, in the rich West, basically give all we can do to emerging economies, not just because of the economic interest, i.e. if they're all fit and healthy, they'll buy more of our stuff, but, you know, on moral grounds, is the Biden administration only doing what is right and proper? Is there any argument against this?
Well, there is some argument. Some would say, just like I believe Angela Merkel, who the chancellor or Germany, she has said she pushes back because, and like others who were in the part of the close, who have relationships with the pharmaceutical industry, they say that it will stunt any form of, or it will hurt rather, incentives, financial incentives for innovation. And which, I mean, depending on where you come from, maybe that may not be so important at the moment, considering the unprecedented, you know, circumstances that we're in. But I would say a better argument against this would be the fact that it apparently there are already nearly 200 agreements between pharmaceutical companies who have the patents and other countries, poor and developing countries, who in terms of being able to create, do the necessary technology transfer. So they are already agreements in place. So maybe this is possibly something of good nature, a kind gesture, but it really is going to be all down in the execution. Because as I said, what you don't want to have happening is you create waivers for the vaccine IP laws, but then if the other companies that are producing it, if they are not able to factor in for quality control and ensure that they are doing it correctly, then you're going to undermine vaccine efforts all across the globe.
Mike, the British government has sent ventilators over to India. Are there any other efforts which the UK government has not just given to India, but to other countries around the world? Tell us about our UK effort in this regard.
It's quite difficult to put in straightforward terms, because the UK government has done as much as it can to help its own friends rather than help the world. I understand, I'm the last person to defend Big Pharma on this stuff, but I can understand how when you're dealing with multinational companies that are spending billions on development of chemicals, that those chemicals then can be given away against the will of the companies involved. If they could do it with agreement, and I'm a bit puzzled at Angela Merkel saying what she said. As you may know, there's been a lot of to and fro between the UK and the EU. There's been a lot of vaccine nationalism that Boris Johnson wanted Union Jacks sticking on the vaccines that came from the UK. So if there are supplies being sent around the world, they'll have Union Jacks and Boris Johnson's face on it.
Laura, let us know what the situation is in Canada regarding vaccines. The last thing I heard, Ford, the Premier, Ontario, was thanking the Biden administration for sending, I can't remember exactly how many, whether it was a million doses of a vaccine up north. And it was, oh, for shame, because at the start of the pandemic, everybody was looking to Canada as one of the countries that was dealing with this well. So why have things changed around? Why are you now going cap in hand, not you personally, but your government, or at least your regional government in Ontario, going cap in hand to the Americans, trying to beg, borrow and steal some vaccine doses? What the heck is going on?
Oh, I personally have gone cap in hand to Biden, to Harris, to anyone on Twitter to help us out. It's a disaster. The procurement, while we had a lot of purchases of the vaccines early on. We didn't have the kind of contracts that guaranteed delivery. There were all kinds of interruptions in the procurement. So basically, you know, the month of March and April, we didn't get the kind of vaccines that we needed. We did get a hand from, we gave a hand to Mexico, but we are desperately in need of more. Now, at this point, they're saying in May, the country will be flooded with vaccines and we might actually be able to catch up a little bit, but not all the vaccines that we need. Some of them we're still having problems with the supply lines on them. And in terms of the actual situation, what's so terrible in Canada right now is that, and I do blame this, so I blame the procurement part and the contracts on Trudeau. I mean, that was his job. But the actual distribution has been a nightmare in Ontario, the most populous province, the one that's the banking and economic center of the country. We have not had a premier who even set up any kind of good system to distribute the vaccines when we did get them. He spent all his time blaming procurement and doing nothing on distribution. It's been like the bloody Hunger Games here trying to get a shot. And we've also had that same premier, Ford. He did not shut down in February when the health officials said it will be a disaster in April if you do not shut down. So we are currently in a severe lockdown. We are now known as the lockdown capital of North America. I think we've been in lockdown more since this pandemic started than anywhere in the world. And, you know, it is just doesn't need to be this way for a wealthy country that has universal health care. So the two provinces that are really suffering both have conservative premiers who kind of did a little bit of the Trump thing. They gave mixed messages. They weren't all in on the science. And so Alberta and Ontario right now, devastated. Our hospitals are overflowed. Our ERs, our doctors are posting videos constantly begging people to stay home, just trying to get through this worst third wave. And on top of all of that, we had one of the advisory groups nationally go on television and say that there was a preferred vaccine, the mRNA, which made everybody like me who took the other kind, the AstraZeneca, wonder what on earth is going on. So, you know, it's been an absolute shambles of a response, a rollout, procurement, distribution, and communication, Royfield. And I am pissed off, as are most Canadians. And I'm hopeful that Biden keeps pumping us full of whatever extras they've got. Because when we see our American neighbors, our biggest trading partner, opening up fully, and we are in a situation like it's worse than it was last April, it's disgusting. It shouldn't be this way. So we need the help and we'll take it. We're not too proud to beg and thank our neighbors. And I hope we never forget what Biden's doing for us.
Gosh. Dawn, the UK is similarly slowly but surely opening up again. Let us know exactly where we are in that reopening up cycle.
Oh, gosh. I think half the nation's confused, actually. We can't have anybody inside our houses, well, unless they're a plumber or whatever. I thought that I might be okay to go and book a hotel and go off somewhere, and I discovered that unless it was still for a very specific reason, I couldn't. So I had to cancel it because they didn't ask me. You can have 6 people 2 meters apart in your garden, in any one garden. You still can't stay overnight in somebody's house unless you're in their bubble. You can't go indoors anywhere in a restaurant or a pub or a bar or anything like that. You can only meet outside to eat, and it's still quite cold here. Though, having said that, in North Somerset, it's a glorious day today, and it's been wonderful in the sunshine. So it's gradually opening up, and huge numbers of us have had our vaccines and will be having our second vaccine at some point or another. And people over 50 have now been told that they're likely to get a booster vaccine by December or in December. Things are definitely getting better. Very, very far fewer people are being admitted to hospital, and only a handful of deaths now each week from people who contracted COVID-19 within the last 28 days. So it looks as though we're opening up, and the warmer weather's coming, so that's got to be a positive thing, because as we know, it seems to be particularly bad in the cold weather and attacks people very badly who have a vitamin D deficiency. So it still feels like we're locked down, basically, Royfield.
Emma, this current administration in the UK, the Boris Johnson one, has played a blinder with distribution of vaccines. Over 50% of UK adults already had at least one jab, and I forget how many have actually had two. We've got to seriously get out our Union Jack bunting, our Union Jack flags, our Union Jack underwear, and wave it all in celebration and appreciation of Boris Johnson and his government, surely.
Well, I don't own any Union Jack underwear, so really? I won't be running those at the flagpole. I mean, yeah, I mean,
have you not got, isn't there a little part of you which is very much Jerry Halliwell with Union Jack? Oh, no, it's a Union Jack top she was wearing, not an underwear. Sorry, go on. Sorry.
I don't own anything with the Union Jack on it, not for particularly political reasons. I just don't think it would suit me. I've always been of the opinion that you should give credit where it's due. The government absolutely fucked up an awful lot of the pandemic, and I said so. But yeah, the vaccines have gone really, really, really well. And thank God for that. You know, I want to go back to normal. I'm very happy that I've had my first jab, feel a lot more confident and happy going out and seeing people. And, you know, as soon as I get my second jab, then it's back to normal, really. My folks have had both their jabs, which is really, really key because they were completely shielding. So, yeah, I do think, I mean, I don't buy your visual. I've never been jingoistic. I think being patriotic is great. We've discussed this at length before.
We have.
The fact that I think the government has done one thing right doesn't mean that I'm suddenly or pro this government. I'm pro government in general, obviously.
Fantastic. Em, can I do this? Can I say very quickly to people that are in the room, this is Mid-Atlantic, the podcast, which we've been doing for years, where we talk about US and UK politics, where we compare and contrast. We now do this on Clubhouse, not quite every Thursday, but most Thursdays. If you're in the audience, feel free to raise your hand if you've got a point which you would like to make. But I'm going to slightly move things on. Today, the UK goes to its local election booths. This could expose the weakness of Starmer's Labour Party nationwide and strengthen a push for Scottish independence. Emma, could you give us a framing? What would be a good result for the Labour Party in these local elections? What would be a good result for the Conservative Party and the Scottish Nationalist Party?
I'm going to go backwards with those. The Scots Nats started really strongly mid-campaign and they've had some internal wrangling. Alex Salmond set up a breakaway party. He's the leader before Nicola Sturgeon. They used to be incredibly close but have fallen out. They were looking at the start of the campaign to win an overall majority. So a good result for them would be to get that overall majority. The system was supposed to be set up in a way that made that almost impossible, but they've done it before. They will almost certainly end up, they will be the largest party. There is really no question about that. The question will be how much of the largest party. And the more interesting question in Scotland is who will be the second largest party. The Conservative leader, Douglas Ross, is widely seen to have had a bad campaign, very one note, very hectoring, whereas Labour has a new leader, which is always sort of a breath of fresh air, in Anna Sawa. So, and he's been widely seen to have had a good campaign. So it could, and it's very, very close. It's very much in the margins. So Labour could end up even with slightly fewer votes than the Conservatives, but well distributed in the right seats, so could end up as the second largest party in the parliament. In terms of the Conservatives, they are almost certainly going to hang on, but romp home in Tees Valley. They will probably hold on in the West Midlands, and Labour will have to ask themselves some very serious questions about why that is. They're looking not to go backwards, and I don't think they will, to be honest. I can't see Labour picking up any councils. I don't think Labour's going to win the West Midlands. Labour will win Manchester and London. I think they're going to lose the Hartlepool by-election by a magnitude of about 10 points, which will cause very serious ructions. If Labour can get a scrape a decent result in the Welsh Assembly and the Scottish Parliament, they will use that to try and deflect from what are going to be disasters, I think, in the West Midlands and Hartlepool.
Chris, you're in London, so you're one of these kind of metropolitan elitists, aren't you? Somewhat of an internationalist. What would be some of the key election themes in the run-up to May the 6th for you?
Right. So I appreciate that you asked me about key election themes rather than, you know, specific races, which as a transplanted Canadian, there's still a kind of, I get vague about the specifics of living in the UK. You know, I kind of know my way to the airports and to the restaurants, and a certain level, the detail just eludes me. But you know, as a political scientist, what I can't help but just remark on is, you know, in politics, timing isn't everything, but today it is. I mean, if these elections were happening, you know, back in October, you know, other people maybe have better numbers, but, you know, I think that Labour was probably running ahead by 10 points over the Conservatives. I mean, certainly Starmer was at that point when the narrative was sort of Boris Johnson's bungling of the pandemic. In May, you know, everyone's talking about this kind of vaccine bounce that, you know, we have very short-term memories in politics, it seems. And right now, people are kind of buoyant about, well, I guess we kind of do have things under control. So we're going to give this person more room to run with things. I do think, you know, I know we're going to talk a bit later about, you know, the UK Navy invading France. And the timing of that is really quite interesting that, you know, on the day of basically everybody going to the polls, you know, we're rattling sabers with the old nemesis, France. And maybe that's just, you know, as a kind of interesting point of trivia of this pandemic. I mean, what is remarkable today is how many elections are taking place because of elections that were delayed last year and now today. It's kind of all happening. So it's going to be interesting to see. There's going to be an enormous sound of people moving in and out of offices, I think, tomorrow, which will be funny just to observe the scurrying that's going to take place. But yeah, but that's the main thing that I'm remarking on is just timing and how, you know, how lucky, in a sense, the Conservatives are that these elections are happening today.
Dawn, you actually are a member of a council. So are you up for re-election today or is this an offer for you?
No. In North Somerset, we don't have any elections that are coinciding at a different year. Ours will be next year, following Bristol. But all the surrounding areas, including Bristol, South Gloucestershire, what used to be the old Avon authority. So we've got South Gloucestershire, Bristol, and North East Somerset and Bath, who also have the metro mayoral elections for the second time ever. The first time there was a great big fuss about them because nobody could understand why we got a city mayor and then we got another layer of this, you know. Anyway, it's been a Conservative who, in fact, didn't even get re-selected to stand again, even though he's been there for the last 4 years as a metro mayor. He's been replaced by another candidate by the Conservatives. He's been invisible, as has the candidate, really. So I think, I'm hoping that the Labour candidate does win, which is a Dan Norris, who used to be a member of Parliament years ago and a junior secretary as well, I think. But it won't immediately affect us here in North Somerset, but I think in the longer term it will, because I think that we will be kind of eventually will be become part of the old territory again, hopefully anyway. So I think that the face of everything is up for grabs at the moment because we had an independent police and crime commissioner for this area, and that's the only election that does include North Somerset. So we had an independent police and crime commissioner, and so that's all up for grabs. And I have no clue whatsoever who's going to win that one, and I don't even know who the candidates are. It's actually been a very kind of quiet election period here in North Somerset because of it.
We live in strange times. So yes, it stands to reason that things have been somewhat muted on the election trail. Last question, the UK's elections today.
Yeah.
How united is the United Kingdom? Will this election expose the gradual parting of the four nations that make up the kingdom, England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland? Mike Holden, over to you. Are we really just like counting down the days, the years until Scotland goes? Northern Ireland will definitely go at some point because of demographics, if nothing else. It's just going to be left with us and the Welsh, isn't it?
It does look very much like that. I mean, as Emma's pointed out, the actual result in Scotland is going to be key tonight. If the SNP get over 50%, they have a mandate to request an independence referendum. Boris Johnson just basically said, well, we're not going to commit you, so you can, you know, forget it. However, there was an interesting piece out this week that the Gina Miller case, which is back from the days of Brexit, the Brexit vote in Parliament, centred around the fact that the referendum was not legally binding. So the argument, the counter argument goes that if the SNP get a majority, let's say, even a 1%, or let's say 2%, 52-48, get a majority, they can hold a referendum under the premise that it's not a legally binding one. But if then Scotland votes in a majority to leave, that puts Johnson and the UK government in a very sticky spot. And yes, the mood music is very much that London rules the roost and everyone else has to do as they're told, doesn't have much of a say in it. So it's no wonder that gradually these areas are going to start wanting their own freedoms. Would hate to see the UK break up, but I fully understand why they would want to do it.
On that note, it behooves me to say this is Mid-Atlantic, the podcast, which we record on Clubhouse. So if you are in the audience, feel free to hold your hand up if you'd like to interject, put one of the pundits right, or just state your case on a specific issue. We're going to move back over to the other side of the Atlantic, and we're going to talk about the GOP and them turning on Liz Cheney. Does Liz Cheney's fall mean that the Republican Party has institutionally taken a hard right turn? Is Trump here to stay? Clint Losey, I believe you got the inside skinny on Liz Cheney. You've been an ex-Capitol Hill staffer.
I am an ex-Senate staffer from Wyoming, which is my home state, and Liz Cheney's home state as well. You know, I'm not sure that the GOP has much farther right to turn, but they're going to try, it looks like. Just, you know, for anyone who has found anything else to follow in the news in the past 3 months, back in February, Liz Cheney faced a vote from her party to oust her from her leadership position. She's the number three Republican in the House of Representatives. And she survived that vote by a vote of 145-61. And so everyone read those tea leaves, and it really looked like two-thirds of the House Republicans were secretly willing to keep her and hoping to put Trump behind them and you know, get back to normal was the common interpretation of that. If 45 members, the House Republicans, change their mind this time around, that's all it will take to punt Cheney out of her position. So, I mean, that kind of leaves the big question then, you know, what has changed in the past 3 months since that February vote that could, you know, move people from supporting Cheney to pushing her out? And I think the thing that has changed is nothing. The Trump wing of the party has not been punished. Trump has not been punished and is still a significant political force in general, particularly among his base. The Never Trumpers have not become ascendant. And the delusion that Trump has won the election is still infecting a huge portion of the Republican base. So that's the real danger for Cheney, is that 45 members will kind of realize that it's not that the party needs to put Trump behind them and move on. It's that Liz Cheney is the person who needs to be put behind them. And that may be what has changed since then that puts Cheney in real danger of being ousted.
Where do Republicans who believe the election wasn't stolen go now? Where do these establishment Republicans go? You know, your Mitt Romneys, etc. Eric Marcus, we haven't heard from you. Why don't you opine on this weighty question?
Ha! What a great question, Royfield. I have been watching this with a bit of glee, horror for the state of our country, but glee because Liz Cheney is a horrible. I won't say she's a horrible person. I don't know her personally. Her politics are horrible. Her father was a miserable person and a great danger to the U.S. So I say it couldn't happen to a nicer person. But in terms of the country, it's just this, it's like the Republicans haven't gone far right. They've gone far delusion. They've gone off a cliff. So it's hard to say where they're going. It's hard to say where they're going or what this will ultimately accomplish for them. I am embarrassed to say how much pleasure I take in watching this unfold. Personally, not for the country. I think for the country, it's a disaster.
Scott, can parties of the left, can the Democratic Party take pleasure in the fact that the Republicans are somewhat imploding? Isn't this a time for solid center whereby the Democratic Party can, you know, the Democratic Party needs an effective kind of opposition? That's what democracy is all about.
Yeah, it's interesting. Thomas Friedman wrote an op-ed about this in the New York Times yesterday. He was kind of arguing that basically that Democrats needed to sort of support what he sees as sane Republicans like Liz Cheney and Mitt Romney and Adam, who's the guy? I forget the guy from Illinois.
Adam Kinzinger?
Kinzinger. Yeah. It's interesting, though, what I find. So first off, this isn't really ideological. It's personality driven, right? I mean, it's not. It's Liz Cheney's is not a moderate or something like that, but position wise, and there's not. It doesn't seem like there's a big pot. There are big position differences between her and the opposition. I mean, the difference is, are you a Trumper and are you denying that the election was stolen? And those are the things that are the fault line. So this, it's yeah. I mean, I think it is an interesting moment politically, but you know, it's just it's interesting Liz Cheney now is sort of is for some people like the face of a moderate Republican Party. I mean, she does not strike me as moderate in the least. But again, her, you know, she's not part of the Trump cult of personality, and so that sort of is where the fracture is. And I think, I do think we need a solid opposition party, and that's not the Republican Party right now. I mean, I struggle to think on any issues like what innovative ideas are Republicans putting forth, and I can't think of many. Maybe school choice. I mean, no, whether or not you're a school choice advocate, I mean, that's at least an idea out there. But other than that, on many of the biggest issues of the day, Republicans just don't have a way forward.
I mean, I think part of the problem there is not just finding common ground on issues. There are, you know, there are a couple where you could find, I think you could, but like you say, it's very rare. But it's just, I think it's really hard for, particularly for the Democrats, to engage on, you know, legislating and, you know, kind of policymaking when there's this huge problem, you know, lurking in the room that is that the people they're trying to work with fundamentally don't respect the rule of law or, you know, the reality of the facts on the ground. So, like, I mean, you can try and find, you know, policy victory that both sides can claim bipartisanship, but at the end of the day, you still have one party who, you know, is supporting rule of law and one party that is totally consumed by this cult of personality. And I think that's, you know, kind of a much deeper rooted problem.
Royfield, you'd ask me if there's a place for people like Mitt Romney and Liz Cheney in the current Republican Party. I should have answered that first. It's a simple answer. No.
It's amazing.
If I can just chip in, I think something that Trump said in January was quite key, that he stood up on stage and said, this is no longer the Republican Party, this is the Trump Party. By dint of not going away, essentially, after being beaten, he seems to be proving himself right.
And the polling shows that. I mean, the polling overwhelmingly, when you poll Republicans and ask who they want to be their 2024 candidate, it's overwhelmingly Trump. I mean, he's not going away. I mean, people that think Trump is going away, I think there's an excellent shot that he's the nominee in 2024.
I agree. I've always thought we shouldn't underestimate Trump way back to before when he was just musing about running years ago. And when he entered, he was what so many Americans really wanted at the time. And he has I think history will look back on him, not in the way that we characterize him now, but in terms of how insidious he was and the skills he had at manipulation and the propaganda. I mean, if you just look, it was Press Freedom Day the other day, International Press Freedom Day. And look at what he has done just in terms of endangering the lives of journalists with his fake news, how that took off. Just a simple slogan put so many people's lives in danger and threatened any kind of accountability and gave support to autocrats around the world. His impact has been devastating, and I don't think we should ever underestimate it. Just because he's not on Facebook or Twitter right now, we're getting a bit of a reprieve, and we're laughing. Get pictures from Mar-a-Lago and, you know, enjoying watching the GOP split itself in half while Biden just charges through and gets some real policies in place. I, too, share the concern that Trump is just planning his comeback. You know, he's going to waltz right back in. Now, will America be so pleased with Biden's leadership that, except for, you know, the diehards are going to look at it and say, hey, we've got something that's functioning, whether it's Biden or Kamala or a combination of both. This is the kind of leadership we need to keep trucking, but we'll have to see. So let's not indulge ourselves too much in thinking that Trump is passé. I don't think he's passé at all.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing here is, you know, Royfield, you asked if there's room for some sort of centrist party. There's no center. There's no center between these two poles. And you know, all of this has its roots in the fire eaters of like the 1850s who basically decided that slavery was a moral good. And developed a whole religion, which is evangelical Christianity, or sect, I should say. It was basically built to justify slavery. And these folks have, you know, there's a through line through segregationists and on to today, of people who they've absolutely no interest in sharing power with people who aren't them. And there's no center with that. Like, how are you supposed to find center between people who are willing to basically take away your right to vote, to have fair representation, to participate in governance? There's no negotiation that they're interested in, and it's really foolhardy to pretend that exists.
Well, when you have leaders coming out having to say we are not a racist country, I mean they're arguing against that negative. I agree with you wholeheartedly, and this is a real moment, as we can all see. Is the GOP going to continue as a party that courts racism? I mean, they came so close to having that caucus, that America caucus, that was flat out racist. This was so, they came, it stopped, but it didn't mean that it didn't get way too close to the edge. And I can't believe that I'm in a conversation where Cheney and Romney are seen as the heroes in the discussion, because, you know, they were such a threat for so long, at least from a Canadian perspective, with their beliefs and everything else, and their warmongering, and especially with Cheney. So, I mean, we are looking at this as neighbors. Thankful there's an adult that's taking care of stuff, so we don't have to be as concerned every single day about what's going on in the U.S. But, you know, the election's coming fast, and I'm not feeling particularly at peace watching this. I think America's got a real question to ask itself about, is it going to fully and finally stop giving voice and opportunity to racists and to people who do hold that belief? It's disgusting to watch.
You know, I think that sort of Liz Cheney's journey since January is like a nice synopsis of kind of the Republican Party's ambiguity since January 6th. I mean, you think back to February when, you know, she's rapped on the knuckles for insisting that, you know, Trump's election narrative is a big lie, but she holds on to her position with, you know, 2/3 of her colleagues' votes. And in part because this is a woman who, you know, most Republicans would struggle to demonstrate as conservative a voting record as Liz Cheney. And that was February when, you know, there was a lot of ambiguity about where is this going to go? Where is the power in the party now? And I think that, you know, the events of this week, where her story has gone, would suggest that, yeah, that ambiguity has faded. And there is a strong recognition that, you know, his power and influence is undiminished. That's still kind of the axis through which success in the party runs. So I agree with you know, Don, Laura, Scott, what you're saying, that, you know, if Liz Cheney is the barometer, it's pretty clear who has the hold on power and the line that we should project into you know, what the next few years for Republican politics are going to look like.
Yeah, I think that's right. I just want to add something to what Chris is saying, that Trump did something unusual as a Republican. A lot of traditional Republicans over the past decades, they court the base, they court the religious right and the populist base. And then when they get elected, they govern a more establishment, right? And they embrace the establishment. Trump didn't do that. I mean, Trump kept doing rallies, kept fighting for the base. He was a sort of champion, you know, for the base over against, you know, quote unquote liberal elitism and all this stuff, and the fake news media. And I think that really garnered a lot of loyalty for Trump, because he didn't leave them standing at the altar. You know, like he has, and that base is powerful. Now, it might not be a big enough base to win a general election. You know, like it ultimately didn't. His base of support didn't garner a victory, but he got the second most votes of anybody in history except Biden. So, I mean, the guy
the problem is with Trump and Trumpism, that whilst he might fire up the base, he also fires up the opposition, doesn't he? And he fires up the opposition more than he actually fires up his own base. So ultimately, it's a losing ticket.
It's interesting. The Republican Party in California is a third party, right? It's the number one party registration is Democrat, then independent, then Republican. So, yeah, I mean, Trumpism could wind up creating this kind of permanent entrenched minority party.
Hi, and welcome to the stage, sir. We're talking about the GOP, where it goes next. What happens to the Liz Cheneys of this world, the Mitt Romneys of this world, if the party establishment is kind of turning its back on those Republicans who believe that the last election actually wasn't stolen? What are your thoughts on this?
Sure. So I think that there's really fascinating civil war playing out in the Republican Party, as I think all of us agree. But it's reaching, you know, a bit of a crescendo this week as, you know, the Facebook Supreme Court decision kind of got handed down, or in this case, you know, kind of punted. But there was a very interesting interview that was done recently with Frank Luntz, who's this Republican pollster that is quite well known in kind of GOP circles. And he encapsulated the conundrum that the modern Republican Party finds themselves in, which is there's an increasing likelihood, you know, it's only 2021, but Trump is signaling that he intends to run in 2024, that a lot of people who thought he was doing that just to freeze the field is in fact serious about doing so. And all of the machinations he's doing to try to create these Trump-aligned people in primaries is evidence of that. But he said, if Trump runs, there is no possible alternative, and there is no way that he doesn't win the nomination. But on the flip side, this Republican pollster said, if Trump gets the nomination, there is no possible way that the Republicans win a national election. And so he thinks that there's drumbeat that Trump is creating right now amongst the big lie and this jihad against Cheney and others is not only hurting Republicans, the brand, if there's anything left to it, in a brand in tatters, but he also thinks that's imperiling the House of Representatives in 2022. Now, it seems like early to think about that, but the early betting on the House of Representatives is that it's a very steep hill to climb for Democrats to hold, and the Senate is already a bit of a toss-up. And here is a Republican pollster. I mean, this guy gets paid by Republicans, has been a lifelong Republican. I've met the guy. There's no more Republican in the old sense of the term, in the Cheney-Romney sense of the term. And he is saying that Trump and his machinations are basically imperiling what would normally be a layup for Republicans, which is to win an off-year election in the House of Representatives. And, you know, the Republicans have painted themselves into a corner that I don't see how they get out of it, because Trump has this Svengali hold on the base, as someone put it so well. The base is too big to ignore, but too small to win any kind of national election. And so I don't know how this plays out, other than there's a splintering of the Republican Party that occurs, which would doom them even further to a minority status for the foreseeable future. So it'll be fascinating to see, but I just don't see how it plays out any other way.
It's a great interview. It's a great, let me just add it. It's Eric here. It's a great interview. I heard it on Kara Swisher and Sway, and on our Sway podcast. And he said, essentially, the Republicans can't win with Trump and they can't win without him. And they're stuck. It was a terrific interview.
And what I was going to add to that is that they can't win without him because, you know, it's really unclear whether or not the Republican base turns out if Trump isn't on the ticket. You know, that seems to be something that contributed to Democrat success in 2018 midterms, in addition to the Democrats were eager to vote just to vote against Trump and the Republican Party. But, you know, if Trump isn't on the ballot in 2022, it's not clear that the folks who are only in it for Trump are going to turn out to vote for Republican candidates, even if they are Trump-endorsed candidates.
Intra-politics aside, I do think that it is very concerning that the Republican Party has essentially doubled down on the culture wars as pretty much a platform rather than any actual policy. I think that is going to be essentially their downfall, because currently, you know, we this country has not gotten any better in terms of, you know, inequality, infrastructure, healthcare, all this kind of stuff. And the lack of a conservative solution, because of the focus on whether it's power retention or even, you know, trivial things like Dr. Seuss and whether or not critical race theory should be taught in high school. These very, very, there's only so long that you can, you know, you can try to distract people with these things and not really have a solution for some very pressing issues, especially ones where their base are going to be affected. I don't know if Trump's policies lasted long enough to where we can see how they affected his base, but I am wondering what is the next move. Once it does become clear how it affected, you know, the Midwest and those, you know, throughout his supporters, essentially.
Yeah, I was going to say that, you know, there's been this alliance between the kind of conservative business people and the right reactionary class, and it worked for them for a long time, right? That was Reaganism in a nutshell, right? If you kind of keep your overt racism and your Armageddonism under wraps, like, you're going to be on the winning side, and we're going to get you where you want to go. The only problem is that conservative business class didn't get folks where they wanted to go. And then when you hear, you know, the Trumpists talk about the establishment, that's exactly what they're saying. Like, we played your game for how long, and what did it get us? It didn't get us shit. And now we're coming for you, right? Like, we're going to Charlottesville. All we want is Charlottesville. And because that's how we feel, you know what? And we're not sorry about it anymore. And they're saying that, right? Like, that should echo everything that you've been hearing from the Trumpists, if you're listening. And the conservative business class is going, oh, wait a minute, like, what happened? And I have no sympathy for the Romneys and the Cheneys. Like, you guys were palling around with horrific, you know, racists for years and years and years. And you may have not been, like, overtly racist on your own, but, like, you were always there. That was always what you were about. Like, I mean, to say Reaganism wasn't racist when he launched his, you know, his campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, which is a place only known for lynching black people. It literally is nothing else. It's that in the state fair. And it was very clear what the dog whistle was, right? And so basically these people who are kind of content to keep it under wraps for the sake of power, like, they're done. And I think that schism and that alliance is gone. And I think what Democrats need to do, what they haven't done, which is basically a death blow to that alliance, is to adopt a real small business message, right? An aspirational, you know, we're going to get rid of racism and provide economic opportunity all in one fell swoop. That's the death blow. Because if they do that, they're a class of kind of independents that's ready for that message. And it will be basically the death of the Republican Party. It will have to completely reconfigure to compete in this country ever again, because their alliance is breaking before our eyes.
Laura, you're going to have the last word on this, and then we're going to start to wrap things up with takeaways of the last 7 days. Go for it, Laura.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We are seeing a Republican Party break apart. It's a real moment for them where they have to do that gut check, and that people who have been, as you say, palling around with racists all this time, it reminds me of that line from Hosea, you know, you sow the wind, you reap the whirlwind, right? They've got a real problem on their hands. And it even affected Canada. A really, you know, billionaire socialite in Canada posted that she took a photo with Trump at Mar-a-Lago last weekend, and the backlash was massive in Canada, just being in a photo with Trump and all that represents. So, you know, those Republicans are going to have a really hard time. They've either got to jump in with the cult, or they're going to be pushed out to the side. Maybe they'll form another kind of party. But I think that the best ticket for the Democrats is the pragmatic approach to just being effective. You know, people in the U.S., if their lives get better, if the economy chugs on, if Biden's COVID response was seen as effective, and he's able to stay away from some of the most, you know, outrageous stuff that can come from the far left in terms of things that will just push people away from the Democrats, I think that the Democrats have a good chance at staying in power. You know, people need to see competency. And so far, Biden has been impressively competent.
Well said. We were going to talk about the UK sending warships to Jersey, but I think we kind of did that a little bit before, and we slightly overran with looking at the ramifications of the GOP turning on its own Liz Cheney. So with what, 7 minutes before the end of the hour, before we wrap up the podcast, I say to you in the audience, if you have a point which you'd like to make, if you think that maybe we've forgotten something, overlooked something, haven't really understood an issue, this is your time to hold up your hand and to quickly jump on stage. But whilst you're doing that, maybe whilst you're pondering whether you should air your views on the podcast and in this room, I'm going to go through everybody in the room. But what are you reading? What are you watching? What has basically excited you in the last 7 days in terms of popular culture? Clint Losey, I'm going to start with you. Now, I know that you're an erudite man. You're cultured. You like a good bakery over there in Washington, D.C. Tell us, sir, what you've been up to in the last 7 days in terms of popular culture.
Obviously, the pandemic has been a lot of binge watching, but there are a couple things that I'm starting to catch up on just now at the end of the pandemic that I missed from the past couple of years, and that's The Americans, which is a pretty fantastic drama about Russian spies, Soviet spies in the U.S. in the 1980s, and then Modern Family, which is a sitcom that ran for 11 seasons, and I just love Modern Family. It is exactly my type of humor.
Big ups to both of those suggestions. I came at The Americans very late in the day. I think I started watching it when it's already on season 4, and it had that utter sense of loss when I finally, number one, caught up. So then I had to wait for the episodes in real time. That was a real pain in the backside. And then secondly, when it was all over, it was utterly gut-wrenching. That's the thing about binge-watching anything, the sense of loss when you actually finally get to episode, you know, when you get to the final episode. Emma Burnell, you're always doing something cultured. Tell us about something.
Well, actually, what I'd like to say is about local government, because that's, you know, most elections that are happening in England and Scotland today, local government elections, it's the most important form of government, really. I'm a very big believer in delivering locally where you can. Sure, national frameworks, making sure that we have national standards, but making sure that we have local delivery networks and local understanding of need. And yet we're not talking about that even on the day that we're supposed to be electing local government. I don't mean us as this group, I mean us as a country. I mean the Labour Party have been, you know, they've done their usual political protest on the NHS, which has absolutely fuck all to do with local government or local government elections. But yet again, we're talking about the NHS. So I just want to shout out to all the people who work tirelessly and thanklessly at the actual coalface where people really live in local government, because I think it's really important and we don't appreciate it really enough.
It's one of the key structural things which is actually wrong with the United Kingdom, is that too much of decision making is made centrally, not enough of it is made locally. Local councils can only raise something like a third of their budgets actually from local taxes. We actually hamstring, we denude local politicians of real power, which is one of the reasons why we've only just had relatively recently this whole layer of local governance around local mayors, metro mayors. And even then, they have little and no power compared to the rest of Europe or even North America. So it's one of the structural things we need to get right. And when we get that right, we'll kind of unleash economically so many cities and towns which are just centrally planned. Couldn't agree with you more. Scott, speak your piece, sir. You are in Nashville, what did I say you were before we started recording? I got it completely wrong. But you're in Nashville. You're sampling the good, you know, the delights of that wonderful, charming city. Tell us somewhere you've been in the last 7 days.
Yeah, you know, I've been to a couple of honky tonk bars, which I've never been to an establishment like this. They're these like multi-story pubs downtown that have like live music on every floor. So it's been pretty interesting. I've met a lot of interesting people. I kind of stick out here as I sort of look and smell and feel like a Northeasterner. Like, so I feel a little bit
What? How do Northeasterners smell? Do they not wash or what?
We smell like lilacs and roses. I mean, Brilliant. we're wonderful.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so that's been, so I've been out and about a bit. I'm enjoying myself. And also, I've been binge watching a bit. I've watched the show called Condor, which, if you like spy thrillers, it's I think it's from Epics. It's excellent. So I'm in the second season, and it's based on the film 3 Days of the Condor, which I think was a Robert Redford kind of spy thriller in the 70s or something. But it's excellent. If you're into sort of spy thriller, you know, sort of stories, it's pretty good. I highly recommend it.
Can I highly recommend The Serpent on Netflix? It's a true story about a serial killer. He actually kind of preyed on the hippie culture, and he traveled around the world and committed all kinds of heinous murders. And it's a pretty amazing cat and mouse kind of movie.
That sounds excellent.
Ab over there in Dallas. No recommendations about alcohol, so no talking about Uncle Nearest. Oh, whoops, I've said it. Tell us something which you've indulged yourself in the last 7 days.
Well, outside whiskey, I am actually getting ready for a book that I ordered recently that I'm really excited for once it arrives. It's called Equality in American Dilemma, 1866 to 1890, Professor Charles Postel. He was actually on Clubhouse, and it is that room that where he was giving interview. It was fantastic and just so great. His knowledge, just how social movements have essentially started and how they died and how they thrived, particularly post Civil War and during the Gilded Age, and what essentially led to various movements that occurred in the 20th century. So that is that. I'm going to indulge myself in that book soon. Other than that, I am actually, believe it or not, getting ready to go to a tea house out nice. Here in Dallas. We have a few tea houses. So I have actually wanted to understand and experience the British afternoon tea culture. And so I'm going to get dressed up and, you know, attend one of those.
Just be careful, right? When you have your scone, right, you put the cream on first and the jam on top. Any other way is pure barbarism. Don't let anybody else tell you there's another way. No, there isn't. It's the end of civilization is the other way. Chris Kochuna, obviously this is, you've now let me down massively, because you know you didn't.
I'm just pointing out that there is
no
another way.
There isn't another way.
I didn't take a stance on the issue.
But even saying there is another way, you're hinting that there are barbarians in Cornwall that will absolutely put the jam on first and the cream on top, which just messes the whole thing up. But anyway, let's not talk about afternoon tea, a delightful English tradition of which I do try and partake in as much as I can whilst actually in California. There's a great place in Alameda just down the road, which is a Malaysian tea house, which I'm going to try soon. I love me some finger sandwiches.
Well, I mean, the HBO has put on the internet its first images in the Game of Thrones prequel, House of Dragon. I mean, we should all go check that out, especially if you need just something to sort of cleanse your palate after the series finale of Line of Duty on Sunday, but I won't get into that.
You know what?
Oh, did you want something more highbrow?
No. Listen, I don't expect anything more highbrow from you, an Oxford Don who travels the world doing motivational, you know, speaking. Game of Thrones is utterly perfect, but remember which way of how to cream your scone, sir. Right, Eric Marcus over there in New York City, a city that I love and adore. And I promise you, the next time I come to New York, Eric, I'm going to be knocking on your door. Where are you going to take me? Where are we going to go?
Oh, there are so many places to take you. I'll take you to the High Line first, the elevated park, and then to my favorite.
I love the High Line. It's
oh, good.
Place. I love it so much. And well, it's a really good example of community partnership between local government and communities.
It is. My neighbor across the garden from me is one of the founders of it.
Oh, fantastic. Well, tell him how much I love it, and I'm raving about it from 6,000 miles away.
I will tell him, I will take you there, Royfield.
Can I just say, I have been to the High Line, but I can walk it again. The first time I went was 2010, when there was only the first mile or so done. The last time I went, it was much further, went all the way, much, much longer. We are copying it in Birmingham. We have an old viaduct, which hasn't been in use for, I don't know, 50, 60 years or so, stands high over Digbeth, this industrial bit of Birmingham, and we are completely ripping you guys up and doing a High Line.
Good,
there.
Good, good. In fact, the people who run the High Line now consult on programs all over the world. So it's,
and so
perfect.
They should. So they should. Anyway, so you're going to take me to the High Line. Where else are you going to take me?
Well, I'm going to take you for a beer at my favorite place, Oaken Hops, which is just around the corner from where I live and just around the corner from the High Line. But in terms of what I'm watching, I binge-watched, which is something I never do, a series called Unorthodoxed, about a young woman who leaves the ultra, well, she's a Hasidic family, and she leaves, she winds up in Berlin. It's one of the most wonderful, moving things I've watched in a long time, and since I grew up around ultra-Orthodox people here in New York City, ultra-Orthodox Jews, they got every detail right. It was extraordinary.
Silly, brilliant bit of drama. And also, kind of like the look and feel isn't of like traditional drama. It almost feels documentary-esque the way that it's kind of filmed. A lot of the actors don't have much of a deep history in terms of kind of their acting career. So there's a lot of kind of like great new talent actually on that. And I remember feeling actually quite sorry for the husband at the end, who tries to understand his wife in unorthodox ways. Brilliant, unorthodox, utterly fascinating, immersive bits. I think there's only about 5 episodes or so. It's not that long.
There were 5, and I was so disappointed when it ended. And I was also felt sorry for the husband. He was just clueless, like so many of the young people. Well, that's a longer conversation, but it was terrific, and I was sorry it ended. Now I want to know what happened to the characters, but they're not real people. Actually, no. The woman whose story this is based on wrote a book called Unorthodox, and I'm planning to read that too.
It's utterly brilliant. There you go, folks. That has been your Mid-Atlantic. We have done, including the Green Room, an hour and 35 minutes worth of chat, of which in between what we like to read, what we like to watch on TV, what media we like to consume, we've dealt with a weighty topic of the UK sending warships to Jersey to frighten the French, the GOP turning on Liz Cheney, and what that means for the future of the Republican Party. We've also looked at the UK council elections and what were the most important pre-election themes and what it means for the future of the United Kingdom. Will it even be united? And we started off by talking about the Biden administration and its vaccine waivers and what that means for the health of the world and also for Big Pharma. I'd like to thank you all, everybody on stage, for joining me on this Mid-Atlantic. You're much more clued up and educated on these topics than me. And thank you for those people in the audience for listening. We do this not quite every Thursday, but most Thursdays. We start off with 30 minutes worth of Green Room chat, where we just lubricate our brains and our vocal cords. And then on the hour, we talk about UK and US politics with Clint Losey, Emma Burnell, Scott, Laura, Eric Marcus, Chris Kachuna, and other assorted friends of mine, of which one of them is Kathy today. So again, why don't you, if you want to be alerted when we go live with these, hit the little green house on the top of the page which says Mid-Atlantic, become a follower, so then you'll never miss out on great opinions and insights from my pundit friends. Take care, everybody. Look after yourselves. Be good. And don't forget, left to center politics is right to center politics. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.